Hey, folks, this is Kevin. In honor of Hispanic Heritage Month this year, we're rerunning some of our favorite risk stories shared by storytellers of Hispanic heritage. And we're so excited to have guest hosts stepping in to share the experience with us. This week, we're welcoming Jorge Rivera Rubio, also known as El George, of the Spanish language podcast, Legalmente Nerd.
Pretty good. Legalmente Nerd, which means legally nerd.
Okay, legally nerd. Buscando problemas?
Almost. Buscando problemas. Looking for trouble.
Good, good, good. And Siempre es Lunes.
Yes, yeah, that was really good. Siempre es Lunes. Always is Monday.
Oh, no, jeez. Well, all three of these are very popular podcasts in Puerto Rico, where George is from. So, now, without further ado, I give you your rightful host for this Hispanic Heritage episode. Here is George.
Hey, folks. Hola a todos. This is George. I live in Puerto Rico, just like Kevin just said, in the Caribbean. And I've been podcasting for over 10 years, and I absolutely love this show. I'm so excited to be here. And just because on this episode of Risk, you're here, Michelle Carlo.
No holy water or no mandrake root or no rosary could have prepared anyone in my building or in my family for the Great Voodoo War of 1976.
That and more. But first, if you're new to the Risk podcast, there's 14 years worth of episodes and lots more series like this Hispanic Life series. Check out the best of Risk episodes or the scary stories episodes or the funny stuff episodes. They're all at risk-show.com/special series. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. That's what I hear when I make another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform that allows you to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/podcast23, all lowercase, and take your business to the next level today.
Now, here's the show.
Risk!
Hello, everybody. This is Risk. O Riego. Nah, it's Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they dared to share. I'm El George, or you can just call me George. And this is Está Pegado by El Timba and Fabio Gianni behind me right now. We're calling this week's episode Hispanic Life Numero Uno, number one, with three true stories that... Let me tell you something about Hispanic culture. I love it. I love being Hispanic. It's awesome. But it's also a little bit hypocrite. Can I say that? I'm Hispanic. I guess I can say that. I mean, I love it, but there's a lot of things we have to work on. Anyway, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Javier Morillo, storyteller we met when Risk was in Minneapolis. Before that, you're here, Laura Wimbles, a story recorded at a Risk live show in Nashville in 2016. You can find Laura at Wimbles on Instagram. But before that, a little something from the author of the memoir, Fish Out of Agua. This story, okay, this I love this story. I absolutely, in fact, I think I heard it like three times just consecutive, because it describes so well something about Hispanic culture that we love to say some things out loud, and then other things we just said it, you know, we never said it out loud, but everybody knows, and in this case, they're gonna hear it out of the window. You're gonna love this. Here's Michelle Carlo with a story she calls Night of the Black Chrysanthemum.
So So I grew up across the street from St. Peter's Church in the Bronx, and that's one of the oldest buildings in the entire New York City. It's this huge church, and it takes up about four blocks. And a lot of kids would play in the graveyard because it was the only place for blocks around that wasn't an abandoned lot that had grass and trees in it. And I spent a large part of my childhood there reading the faded gravestones that were like from the 1600s. Or if there was a fresh grave, you would look around it to see if you could find any money, because once my cousin Benny found a $50 bill near one. And it was just a nice place when you just wanted to have some peace and quiet. You know, you might think it's strange that, you know, kids would go and play in the graveyard, but I didn't think there was anything wrong with it because, you know, when you grow up Latin, like I did, all various forms of religion are part of your everyday life. You know, it's not anything strange to you. Like, for example, my Titi Ophelia, she used to keep a glass of water behind the door in her apartment. So if you brought anything evil into the apartment with you, presumably the evil would go into the glass of water and drown. And she used to think that, you know, there was a lot of evil coming into her apartment because the glass was always empty. Now, I knew because when I went over there, I would see her dog drinking out of it, but I never said anything to her. And then my Titi Carmen, she had this plant that was kind of moved. I think it was a mandrake or something. It was like a root, and it looked like it moved. And when my brother had this bad ear infection, they put it on him, and like he sweated out his fever. And I was like, whoa, what kind of plant is that? And like my mom used to pray a lot. I mean, she was like half Catholic and half Pentecostal, and they were always fighting with each other. But sometimes she had this like little rosary, and if she was sitting by the window and the light was right, it looked like she was counting like rainbow prisms in her hand. Like it was like really, it was beautiful. I mean, you know, she's like praying in front of a window, but it just like looked really pretty. But, you know, no holy water or no mandrake root or no rosary could have prepared anyone in my building or in my family for the Great Voodoo War of 1976. Ten years before, my family had been the first Puerto Rican family ever to move to that building on St. Peter's Avenue. And for years, we had to endure all the Irish and Italian families complaining that our food stank, our music was too loud, and we kids ran wild through the halls. Like, never mind that my mom fed us like stovetop stuffing and instant mashed potatoes. And the only music that they ever played was like Johnny Cash and Santana. Okay, all Puerto Ricans listen to Santana. But like my brother and I were never allowed to play in the hall. And okay, come on, like the Irish are peaceful and garlic doesn't stink, please, you know. But so when years later, two other Puerto Rican families moved into the building, we thought, oh, hey, we'd have allies. But the Garcia and Morales families, they kept to themselves. And the teenagers, they didn't listen to Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath or The Who, so therefore they were useless to me. The little kids weren't allowed to play with anybody else, so my brother couldn't play with them. And when my mom tried to talk to them, all she could find out was that they had come from the same town in Puerto Rico, but they had bad blood between them. And my father was just like, well, if they hated each other over there, why the hell did they move in over here? We never knew what started this installment of their war, but all of a sudden there was just like yelling in the alleyway. Like people would like hang out the window and they would just like yell at everybody. They was like cursing, but not just like saying, fuck you, son of a bitch kind of cursing. No, this was just like curses. Like these were proclamations from one family to the other for like barren wombs and brain tumors and infidelity and madness and incurable diarrhea and unemployment and more incurable diarrhea. And, you know, it would have been funny if they hadn't sounded so serious. Not too long after that, I came home from school one day and I found three shiny copper pennies in a triangle in front of the Garcia's door, and there was like this powder sprinkled around it, looked like cornmeal. So I picked up the pennies and I brought them into the apartment and I told my mother what I had found, and she ran to the door, she looked and she saw the cornmeal, and she took the pennies, she opened up the window five flights down, she threw the pennies out the window, and then she made me scrub my hands with rubbing alcohol and that lava soap. And then she told me to never, ever, never, ever, never, ever, never look at or touch anything in front of the Garcias and the Morales family's apartments ever, ever again. Fine. Except that every couple of days now, I would come home from school and there would be something else not to look at or touch in front of either the Garcias or Morales' apartments. Like one day there were kernels of corn arranged in patterns in front of the Morales' apartment. Then a couple of days after that, there were all these dead flowers scattered in front of the Garcias' apartment. And then the day after that, there were these candles and strange groupings in front of the Morales' apartment. And it just went on and on and on. And then, you know, I didn't pay any attention to it because I didn't look. I didn't touch. I don't like that lava soap. It rips your hands up. But one day I went into St. Peter's Cemetery to walk around to be alone. I mean, I didn't play looking for praying mantises or $50 bills in front of graves anymore. But I needed to be alone because, you know, I'm a teenager. And I had found out that day that yet another boy that I had a mad crush on had refused me by saying that I had a nice ass, but an ugly face. And I just was crying. I was just crying. And I sat down like on a little, like, you know, rock under a tree, just, you know, looking in the mirror and like, I'm ugly, I'm ugly. And I put my hand down and I jerk up. Because what I had put my hand down on was what looked a lot like a pair of freshly cut chicken feet tied around with a red string and tied to that to an envelope that was addressed to the Morales' family. Well, I just jumped up and I grabbed the envelope and I took it home and I said, Ma, look what I found. Look what I found. And she just like looked at it out the window again. And then she goes right to the Garcias family and she knocks. Mira, I know you're in there. I know what you're doing and it's not sanitary. You have to think. Children play in that graveyard. And then a voice came out warning my mother in Spanish that if she didn't get away, she was going to be next. So my mother just like goes into the apartment and slams the door and we were just like, what the hell just happened? But the next day, there was a skinned, crucified mouse taped to the Morales' door. The Morales family moved out in the middle of the night, cursing and screaming, and there's back and forth invective between the two families. And, you know, it's entirely in Spanish. But who understood this? This is not language that my family used. So my brother and I just put the TV on louder. We're doing our homework, and this family moves out. And my mother is furious. She was like, this is not right. Somebody's got to do something. And my brother is just like, what are you going to do, Ma? Get Titi Carmen's plant after them? And my mother was like, no, worse. And she went into the bedroom and she shut the door. Now, what had just been this little, simple little clash between the Puerto Rican Hatfields and the McCoys just became this huge thing of Armageddon. And my father decided that he needed to go work an extra night shift. So he just like left us there with my mother. And what my mother did was she went into the bedroom and she took out her King James Bible and she opened the window and she started reading the Bible out the window all night. She was reading the Bible out the window when my brother and I went to sleep. She was reading the Bible out the window when my brother and I left for school the next morning. She was reading the Bible out the window when my brother and I came home from school. And when my father came home and almost burnt down the kitchen trying to cook us dinner, my mother was still reading the Bible out the window, and now she was reading it in Spanish because the Garcia family was yelling curses at her. Now, this is when my father decided that he needed to work another double night shift. So he just left my brother and me alone behind the front lines. And my brother and I, we tried our own counterattack. We tried blasting late night reruns of The Honeymooners and Hogan's Heroes and Rat Patrol on a little 12-inch black and white television. But we were no match for the almighty word of Jesucristo Dios, Almighty God. Finally, we were exhausted. We fell asleep. And the next morning, I wake up. It's quiet. And I, you know, my mother comes in, she's getting us up for school, and I'm like, Ma, what happened? She goes, oh, the Garcia family, they are gone. And she's like, here, do you mind taking out this garbage on your way when you go to school? So I'm like, they moved out? How do you know they moved out? So, you know, I go downstairs, 5 flights of stairs, and I go to the alley, and I see just like belongings strewn all over the place, and it looked like just somebody was just throwing things out the window. So I put the garbage down on top of the garbage can, and I look up. And I see that there's pieces of paper fluttering around still. And I pick one up. And it's a page from the Bible. And I pick up another piece of paper. And it's another page from the Bible. And I look up again. And I see my mom and dad's bedroom window, which is in between the Garcias and what were the Morales' window. So like, not only had my mother spoken the word of God out that window, she hurled it at them. And so the Great Voodoo War of 1976 was stopped by the one force that no curse on this planet Earth has any power against: the righteous fury of a Latina mother who is scorned. And even though my mom later on said that, oh, she needed to repent because she ripped up the Bible and threw it out the window, I had to think that even though it's like totally nuts, in a way, it was kind of punk and kind of cool. I mean, when you think about it, my mom out crazied the crazy people and mama got the job done.
We'll be right back.
Once upon a time, a Tony box appeared.
A musical storybox, a treat for my ears.
It was scream-free and joyful and taught them new words.
There's hundreds of stories, lots to be heard.
Peppa Pig.
I picked one at bedtime, fell asleep super fast.
Then I relaxed on the sofa. At last! For 10% off your Tony box, use code STORY10 at tonies.com. TONIES.com.
Happy listening.
At Barclays, we know money can be tricky to navigate. We're here to help you find your way around it. Like saving for a trip away. Because when you want a romantic weekend in Rome, you need to take care of the numerals. With savings goals in the Barclays app, you can set a target and see your progress. So you'll be ordering gelato before you know it. Search savings goals in the Barclays app. Barclays, make money work for you. Savings goals tool only available in the Barclays app with selected savings accounts. T's and C's apply. 16 plus.
We're back.
So my mom and I are sitting across from each other at a diner. It's Thanksgiving Day. And my father, who I haven't seen or talked to in 13 years, has just walked in and unknowingly sat down 10 feet away from us. My mom turns to me, eyes wide, and says, "Holy shit, should we leave?" Now, growing up, all I wanted more than anything in the world was to be a white girl. I wanted blonde hair, blue eyes, creamy porcelain skin. And every day that I woke up and looked down at my brown skin, I would just have the same realization: God damn it, still Hispanic. I was adopted into a white family when I was 2 months old. And we lived in Berea, Ohio, which is 15 minutes outside of Cleveland, just far enough to make it all white. I was always the brownest person anywhere that we went. I was very used to, from a young age, looking differently than everyone. And the kids at school noticed. I was not an attractive child. My mom kept my hair very short. I essentially looked like a miniature Aziz Ansari. mustache and all. So the white kids at school, they just saw a brown person who didn't look anything like them. So I was called a spick, I was called a beaner, I was called a nigger, I was called a wetback. Anything you could think of, they just threw it at me. I wish that I could say my home life was a little bit better, but it wasn't. My mother was the most caring, supportive person in the world. She just wanted to give love and loved to love. But my father was completely different. He was this just large, hulking man of negativity. And the relationship between my father and my mother was essentially non-existent. I never actually physically saw them touch, not once. One of my earliest memories is actually with my father, and I'm about 4 years old, and we're at a restaurant, and I'm doing something that is totally normal for a four-year-old. I'm eating fries, and after I eat one of the fries, I lick my fingers. And in one white, hot flash of searing pain, he had taken his large ham hand and just cracked me straight across the face and pointed at me and said, "Don't you dare lick your fingers. We're not that poor." Well, then why are we at Denny's? Regardless, though, if he wasn't hitting me for just inane, innocent things, he was regarding me with disdain. if we would run into coworkers of his, they could immediately tell that we looked very different, and they would say, oh, who is this? And he would just kind of look at me with side eye and be like, oh, this is my adopted daughter. I always had to point out that I was adopted. My mom, she, even though I didn't want to be a Hispanic child and I hated the skin that I was in, she tried to help me with cultural identity. And when I was about 7 years old, she took me to the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which was a huge mistake because I still had it in my head that I wanted to be Punky Brewster. And we're at this Puerto Rican Day Parade, and there's music and there's dancing and there's costumes, and I just had a complete and total meltdown. I started screaming, I don't know why we're here. I'm not Hispanic. I'm not like these people. This music is too loud and the food stinks. And I'm just screaming. So my mom just places her hand gently over my mouth and drags me away from this scene of staring Hispanic people. We never went back to another Puerto Rican Day Parade. Thankfully, though, my parents got divorced around that same time when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And once my father was out of the house, I didn't have to live in that tension, that just unsettling feeling of discomfort in your own home. But we were supposed to have these weekly court-ordered visits where he would come and pick me up every Saturday at noon. And I would just build these fantasies up in my head about things that we could do together, things that would maybe make him want to be around me and want to see me the way that I just should have been seen by him, the person who was supposed to be my father. And so I would imagine us going bowling or just anything, anything fun. And noon would come and noon would go. And I would be sitting on the couch with bated breath waiting for him. And then 1 o'clock would come and then 2 o'clock. And eventually, maybe around 4 or 5, he'd show up in whatever leased sports car he had at the time with no apology, no reason why he was late. We'd maybe go get a quick bite to eat, stop at a hardware store, and then I'd be back at home in less than 2 hours. Anything that I had built up in my head, it just never happened. Now, when you don't put any effort into anything, relationships or otherwise, it just atrophies. And so by the time I graduated high school, we were maybe seeing each other once or twice a year. My freshman year in college, he called one day out of the blue and said he had gotten a new car and did I want to go grab lunch? And I was like, kind of apprehensive, but I said, sure, why not? So he picks me up. I'm in the car with him maybe 10 minutes, and we're at an intersection downtown, and there was one of those guys with the squeegee and the spray bottle and the dirty rag, and he comes up to my dad's windshield and starts washing it, and my dad flips out, and he's like, get the fuck off of my car, get the fuck off of my windshield, and starts to roll his window up, and then shakes his head and says, Jesus Christ, these fucking spicks are everywhere. Yeah, asshole, they are everywhere, including sitting next to you in your car, your own daughter, who is also a spick. And in that moment, I didn't care what he had had planned for the day. I didn't care about trying to force some conversation out of him. I could not stand to be in that car 1 second longer. So I got out in the middle of the street, slammed the door, and walked away without looking back. I didn't look back at him, and he didn't come after me. He didn't call after me. He didn't chase after me. And that was when I was 19, and I never saw him again. I became a photographer in my 20s and started shooting weddings. And I would see these fathers and daughters together at weddings having these, you know, close dances where they're crying and clutching each other. And I never really understood that, you know, like, oh, this is my little princess that I'm giving away on her wedding day. But there was one wedding where I'm shooting this father and daughter, and I'd watched them interact together all day. They weren't the sappy, normal father, daughter, daddy, princess thing. They were laughing and enjoying each other's company. They were actually friends. And then while I'm shooting them during the father and daughter dance, as they're laughing, something cracked inside of me. That cold slab of my black heart that had just been emotionally dead broke open, and I burst into tears. I started crying like an asshole behind my camera as I'm shooting these people and trying not to let on that the wedding photographer has completely lost her shit. But it was in that moment I realized I was never going to have that. I was never going to have that dancing partner. It just wasn't going to happen for me. Also, in my 20s, even though I never saw my father, I still felt like I saw him everywhere. Particularly in the men that I dated, which is probably very shocking, I know. I found myself in this relationship, this 8-year relationship with this guy who I just desperately sought his approval. From day one, it was pretty clear he was not really that interested in me, but as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, challenge accepted. Player two has joined the game. Like, I know how to work this. I will make him see me. So we were together 8 years. He was very critical of my weight. He was never interested in having sex either, and one day he let out that the reason he wasn't interested in having sex is because he wasn't that attracted to me and that I should lose the gut and we'll talk. Exact words. Instead of leaving him like a normal person would, I just developed a rampant eating disorder because, frankly, it seemed a lot easier and cheaper than moving out. So I lost about 45 pounds, and I got down to that elusive size zero that we all save up for, you know. And throughout the whole time we were together, he had always made it a point to tell me he never wanted to get married. So when he proposed out of nowhere, I was like, oh my God, I did it. I finally cracked him. He actually sees me for, you know, being worthy. And about a week before the wedding was to take place, he came home one day and he looked at me and he's like, oh my God, look at your legs. They're so skinny. It's disgusting. So I had gone through all of that. I ran myself ragged, starved myself, and it still wasn't enough. So I was like, you know what? I can't marry this person. And I tried to break up with him. He refused. He said, you can't walk away from me now. Everyone's eyes are on us. Let's just get married, and then if you still hate me in a month, we'll get a divorce when no one cares anymore. So I felt trapped, and I did what any girl would do in that situation. I called my mom, and I said, Mom, I cannot marry this guy. I don't know what to do. And she said three words that changed my life. She said, then you won't. So on a beautiful day in October, 5 days before the wedding was to take place, I called the whole thing off. Now, so Thanksgiving was looming around the corner, and my mom herself had just gotten out of a 12-year relationship. So both of us, she decided that year that she wasn't going to do the Thanksgiving. She didn't want to cook. She told me, let's find a restaurant. We'll just go and have someone else do the work for once. And you know, we've both had a shit year, so let's just relax a little bit. So I find this diner in Cleveland that's serving Thanksgiving dinner, and we go there, and it's back to how it was when I was growing up. It's just the two of us, we're laughing, we're reveling in this moment of, you know, realizing where else we would be if we hadn't had these major life changes that we had gone through this year. And after we placed our food order, that's when I saw my dad walk in through the door, never looked at us, but he walked in and sat down 10 feet away from where we were sitting. And I just start involuntarily shaking, kind of like that scene in Jurassic Park where the girl has the jello when she sees the velociraptor rounding the corner. And I'm just like, and my mom's like, what? What's wrong? I'm like, you don't need to turn around. It's fine. Don't. And she's like, of course she turns around. She's like, oh shit. Should we leave? And I'm like, well, we haven't even gotten our food yet. Like, why would we let him ruin Thanksgiving too? You know, but just as quick as that shock and horror had come on at seeing him, it was gone again because he was no different than anyone else sitting in that restaurant. He didn't know what I was thinking. He hadn't cared to know what I was thinking the past 13 years. He didn't even know I was there. He was a stranger. Just like everyone else, except he and I shared a same last name. That was it. Throughout my adult life, I had quietly mourned that, oh, well, you know, I didn't have this rock, this father figure that I thought I had to have, this dancing partner. I would never have that, but it didn't matter because I'd been leading myself this whole time, and I'm just fine.
It's your land. This land is my land. From you and me.
When you're Puerto Rican man and you reach the age of, say, 26 or 28, and you've never brought a girlfriend home to meet your parents, they kind of stop asking you, hey, when are you going to get married? My parents and I, especially my mom and I, we were pioneers of don't ask, don't tell, like way before Bill Clinton. Like, we just talked around things. The way I imagined the rules of our don't ask, don't tell sort of policy worked in my mom's head, it was sort of like, you know, I know, but if you tell me, then when your tías ask me, why hasn't Javi gotten married? And I say, you know, Javi, he studies so much, he has no time for girls, then I'd be lying. And, you know, it's true, I didn't have time for girls. So I grew up in Puerto Rico, and my parents are both born and raised on the island. They grew up very poor. My mom lost her mother when she was very young, and she grew up going from sibling to her older sibling. She'd go from house to house, or in several of these houses, she would essentially work as a maid. My mom learned to iron clothes at 5 years old. And my father grew up in a very rough neighborhood as well. And when they fell in love and decided to get married, there were not very many pathways out of poverty in Puerto Rico. And he chose one of the few available. He joined the army. And so we lived around a lot of different military bases until I was about 7 years old when we moved back to Puerto Rico and moved on a military base there. We lived there until I graduated from high school and went to college in the States. And so this thing in, about me that I really did not know how to deal with or talk about, mom and I always talked around, which is, but that's not to say that we didn't, you know, didn't talk. Like when I was in college, mom and I talked a lot. I had long conversations on the phone. And when I went home for vacations, like we would stay up really late and talking until all hours of the night. Usually we'd only stop like when my dad would, you know, wake up in the middle of the night, like one eye open, like come out in his white jockey underwear and yell at us like, yeah, sing, tarde, another meeting. So we'd go to bed. And my dad, he can be a man of very few words. Like a phone call with my dad essentially goes like this. Javi, ¿cómo estás? ¿Todo bien? ¿Te pongo a tu mamá? It's like, hey, how you doing? How you doing? Everything good? Let me put your mom on. And so when I came to the States for college, that's when I actually, you know, came out as gay and became this very sort of strident, you know, activist, but not when it came to Puerto Rico, not when it came to my parents. And my mom and I, over the years, when the way that we talked around the issue was to talk about someone else. We talked about my cousin Tony. Tony was everyone's favorite. Tony was my mom's favorite because he was about her age, because her sister was a lot older than her. He was her nephew, but they were about the same age. And when mommy lived with his family when she was a teenager, she always told us that Tony was the only person in the house who did not treat her like the maid. And Tony was my favorite because when we moved back to Puerto Rico, you know, we'd lived a bunch of different places, and I always have spoken both English and Spanish. And when I was like 7 years old, we moved back. The rest of my family most were not bilingual. And so I knew Tony was a college English professor. And so we became friends, and he was always very encouraging of me. I was this bookish, nerdy kid, and he would take my sister and me to see plays, and he'd buy poetry books and stuff. And he was just this really great guy. He wore the corn-rimmed glasses, kind of nerdy college prof guy, and just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And when I was in high school, Tony started to get really sick. He had like a liver, some kind of liver disease. And he was getting increasingly sick and in and out of the hospital. And by the time I was a junior and I was thinking about coming to the States for college, Tony got really sick. And it was pretty clear that he was not going to make it. And mommy would come back from the hospital and just distraught. And I remember her sort of saying how painful it was for her to see that the nurses were all wear like hazmat suits and were afraid to touch him. And she said that they looked like astronauts. She didn't understand why. The closest Tony and mommy came to actually talking, I think, truthfully, was when Tony said to mommy, They tell me that what I have, you get from needles or sex. And, you know, I've never done drugs. When mommy told me this, she added, you know, but it was sex with women. The night Tony died, mommy was with him by his bedside with his siblings. And the next morning, his sister drove mommy home. And when she walked in the door, she collapsed into my arms and we sat on the sofa and she sobbed and she just talked for a while to me and my sister and told us in her grief and pain a lot more than she would have otherwise. And she talked about how painful it was to see him go. And that night after he died and they were sitting around his bedside, his sister got very angry because she saw the death certificate. And she said to their brother, their other sibling, who was a doctor, said, "You have to rip that up. You have to write another one. I can't take this because I have to take it to his job for insurance. I have to take it to the funeral home." And the funeral home was in their hometown and everyone knew them. She said, I can't take that. And so he did. He ripped it up and he wrote up a new one, one that did not have those three letters, HIV. And mommy told us this and was so sad, but also angry. She was really angry. She said, because his sister on the way, on the drive from the hospital to our house, had spoken too much and told mommy that Tony was indeed gay and about how their father had been really cruel to him and how he had led this really sad life. And mommy is sitting on our sofa and sobbing and saying, "Con este dolor que yo tengo, este día me vine a decir esto." With this pain that I have, today of all days, she tells me this. What I heard was that the pain of Tony's death was enormous, but knowing that he was gay, that was unbearable. And that was something that I carried with me. I did not go to see Tony in the hospital when he was there. And I told myself and I told everyone that I didn't want to see him that way. But I know now that just sounded lofty, sounded like a high-minded way of disguising. What it really was is that I just was scared. I think I was just fearful of what his life and his death meant about me. So when I came to the States and became this sort of activist in college, and as soon as I came out to myself and I led immediately a very open life in every respect, except when it came to mommy. But over the years, it was through Tony that we talked about me. I made it my crusade to rescue Tony's memory. And over the years in conversations, I just made mommy acknowledge and insisted she acknowledge that he was indeed gay and that was okay. I made her acknowledge the absurdity that our family had become very divided after he died because there were parts of the family that were saying very horrible things about Tony. They were saying horrible things. They were saying that he was gay and they were saying that he had HIV. And I made mommy acknowledge the absurdity that those who loved Tony the least were the ones telling the truth. And those of us who loved him the most loved him through lies. And over the years, it was through Tony that we spoke, but again, always about him and not about me. And even though I, you know, led this very open life in the States, I was fine with that. And I was, part of it too, was just this, for me, this reaction, you know, like when I, you know, came out in the late 80s and in college here, gay white male identity seemed to be defined by like, that you had to be out at every minute of the day. If there was any moment of the day where someone did not know you were gay, that you were betraying the cause. Like, if you're like, this is the barista, like, a latte, I'm a homosexual. And that was the only way that you were truly gay. And that just felt really, like, forced and, like, so confessional and so much talking and very white. And I thought, you know, I rejected all that. And I also thought, you know, that I was being kind, actually, and generous to my parents because by not naming it, then they weren't lying. And that was true for a very long time. And I was okay with it for a very long time. And we were good, you know. My graduate school friend, John, came to visit Puerto Rico. He met everyone, and everyone was like, "Hey, this is Javi's friend, John, his best friend. It's all good." And as the years went by, it stopped being okay. I don't know exactly when it stopped being okay, but how it manifested itself was that Mommy and I just became more distant from each other. I didn't talk as often because it became increasingly difficult to talk around something, you know, like your best friend doesn't move with you to Minnesota. It doesn't normally happen. And I didn't really fully understand how not okay I was with it until my sister sort of broke the seal of silence. And this was in Thanksgiving 2006. So if you're doing the math, I was a grown-ass man by this point. And it's Thanksgiving. I'm here in Minnesota. And I get a text from my sister and says, Mommy knows you're gay and she's okay with it. And I write back, could you explain that? And so it turns out that Mommy and my sister Tina had this conversation and it was very open and great. And I was like, oh, wow. And Tina was like, yeah, it's fine. And so as it happened, I was planning to be in Puerto Rico that Christmas. So I went to Puerto Rico and I thought, well, this is going to be the trip where we're finally going to actually have the talk. But as soon as I got there, I realized something was very weird and that, you know, it was holiday season and my brother was there. My sister lives in Puerto Rico. My brother was visiting like me and Mommy was avoiding being alone with me. It was very apparent, like there was no late night talks and she just was avoiding being alone with me. And I didn't know why. I don't know if she regretted telling my sister or she did, I don't know. And it wasn't until the last night I was home that I was like packing my suitcase and she was crying. We always have very tearful goodbyes. And I forced the conversation. I said, Mommy, I know you and Tina talked. And she didn't say anything. I said, I need you to know that I'm a very happy person. I have a very good life. And she didn't say anything. And we just sort of, you know, finished in silence. And I left, came back to Minnesota and was so hurt, but so angry. I was just really angry at my mom for wanting to continue this, like, let's not talk about it thing. I'm angry at my sister for raising my expectations. And I didn't talk to either of them for quite some time. It was several months. And when we finally did talk on the phone, I called it out and said, I'm not going back to that. And said to my mom how painful that had been, that she had been avoiding being alone with me. And she denied avoiding me, but she only denied it once. And we talked. It was just a little uncomfortable, and our calls were few and far between. And it wasn't until the following Christmas that I realized that Mommy had clearly been working through things on her own. When that Christmas, I did not go home, so I, you know, got a box from my parents with gifts, and I opened it, and there were in this box two gifts: one for me, and one for John, pajama bottoms, which. I thought it was weird. I mean, she went from don't ask, don't tell to like imagining us in bedclothes. But okay, Mommy. But Mommy insisted still, like through my sister, into that my dad couldn't know, my dad would not be able to handle it. It was, you know, fast forward a few years after that, 2008, I was visiting them. And this trip was the first time in years that it just felt like we just had a great time, stayed up late at night. My dad came out in his white jokey underwear and yelled at us to go to bed. And my last night there, we had this really, Mommy and I had this intense conversation. It was really great. We talked about Goni. We talked about me. I told her, you know, just so she'd know, you know, John and I, we'd had like wills and medical powers of attorney and stuff. If anything ever happened, he's good, you know. And it was just it was a great conversation. And I said to her, I said, you know, I'll follow your lead. You say that, you know, I can't tell that. She said, you can't tell your father. He wouldn't be able to handle it. And I said, well, what do you think he would do? Disown me? Like, there's no money. And like, but she reacted really badly to that. Because my father, one thing that he's very sort of stereotypical about, Latino father, is very family oriented. He's always lectures us about family. And she's like, no, he would never do that. And I said, well, that, right. And I mean, I'll follow your lead, but I think he'd be okay. And so the next day I'm coming back to Minnesota and we have our very tearful goodbyes and say goodbye and I leave. I drive out in my rental car, but no sooner had I left our neighborhood, I get a call on my cell phone and it's Mommy. And she said, I answer it. She says to me in Spanish, tu papá quiere hablar contigo, gives it to my dad. And my dad says to me, we love you. We love you very much. I love you too. And then he hung up. And then And I'm like, oh, okay. So I found out later from my brother that what had happened was that when I left, mommy was like crying hysterically more than usual, even. And my dad got really worried. And he's like, what's going on? What's wrong? Is Javi okay? And my mom, who I should preface, does not normally sound like an actress in a telenovela. In this instance, she says to him, nos tenemos que quitar las máscaras. We must take off our masks. If this were Telemundo, like her makeup would be running and she'd be wearing a gown. But it's my mom, she was in clothes, no makeup. And nos tenemos que quitar las máscaras. To which my father responds, you think I'm an idiot? And that's how I came out to dad. No words. And ever since then, it's only difference is now when we talk on the phone, he says, ¿Cómo está? ¿Todo está bien? ¿Cómo está John? ¿Te pongo a tu mamá? It's like, how you doing? Things good? How's John? I'll put your mom on. You know, when I think back in all these years, and, you know, when I came to the States and all the fear of coming, it felt just so dangerous to be gay and with AIDS, and just the fear that I felt of like rejection from my family or that I'd be letting them down. And thinking about this, like for this story to tell this tonight, it felt dangerous because I've told you things here that are still secret, are still not openly talked about in my extended family. And when I started to put together, I knew that I had to change my cousin's name because people might hear this in the family and get very upset with me. And then I remembered that I'd not gone to see Tony in the hospital. And I remembered that his story and his life, they didn't just become a part of my life, but his story and his life made my story and my life more possible and happier and better. And so I just knew that I could not come out on a stage and not say his name. Tony, thank you.
Riesgo. Nah. This is Risk. This is Willie Rosario with No More Blues. And let me tell you something really quick. That's what we call salsa gorda, which is the kind of song that you want to play when you want to dance real close to your significant other. Anyway, we just heard from Javier Morillo, who you can find on Twitter at Javi Morillo. I want to say something. All these three stories, like I said, they really touched me in some way. But Javier specifically, you know, when I was a kid, I was really shy. Like, I'm still am really shy. But I was terrified of girls, of women, you know. And I'm still am right now, actually. Not that much. But the thing is that because I was terrified, I was so shy, I will say that I didn't like girls. Just because I didn't want anybody asking me if I had a girlfriend or if something like that. And that stopped being cute in my family at one point, so they asked a friend of the family to sit me down and talk to me seriously about not liking girls. I was 10 or 11, you know. Anyway, I just revealed to him that I actually do like women and I'm just shy and I will be shy the rest of my life. Anyway, I can't say I understand what LGBTQ people go through. That would be ridiculous. But I do know what is to be looked on by your own family, by your own friends, simply because you're not conforming to the way it should be. And I'm really, really happy that the new generations are kind of changing that. And just stop asking little kids if they have boyfriends or girlfriends. Just stop that. Anyway, about Laura, she just let us know that a month after she performed the story, she found out her father had passed away some months early and actually hit her harder than she expected. But The good news is that she went to therapy and she actually quit drinking. And after that, she's hosted a show. She got a regional Emmy nomination for that. She made a movie. And she's completely sure that none of that could have been done if she were still drinking. And we're very happy for her. And I'm very happy for her because her story was really, really deep. It touched me personally because of my own relationship with my parents. But also, I really hope that she has connect with her Hispanic roots, and or at least thinking about it, because Hispanic cultures are not the same. We're not only one big monolith. We're not. But if there's one thing that join us, unite us, is that our love for life, our love for living life and enjoying life, and I'm pretty sure she can get a kick out of that. And then about Michelle, let me tell you this quick story. I love the story because, man, in Puerto Rico, most people are religious and mostly Christian, but man, we love the Santeria and Brujeria, which are just words for witchcraft, you know, kind of word for witchcraft. And quick story, I used to walk from my school to home. And in the middle of the way, there was this store. It was called a Botanica, which translates to botany store or plant store. But in Puerto Rico, and I guess other countries, Hispanic countries, or especially in the Caribbean, they used to buy things so you can do your own brujería or santería. And there was a sweet smell in there. Then I found out that that's because they use this kind of brew, and you go in there for a limpia, a cleansing, to get rid of evil spirits and curses. And my mom will always tell, my mom was very Christian, very religious. She said, never go into that store. Never go into that store. If you can, just walk on the other side of the street. So I did that, right? Even in the other side of the street, you can smell the store whenever you walk past it. So anyway, what to my surprise, did I not found some candles on my mom's room one day, the same candles that I see every day when I walk past the store. So that should tell you a lot about Hispanic culture.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Well, everybody, don't forget that brand new episodes of Risk come out every Tuesday, and more Hispanic Life episodes will be coming over the course of the next several Thursdays. Everybody, today's the day. Take a risk. Go do it.